Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Modern Maturity. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And for the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you from the April-May edition or issue of AARP Magazine. And last week, we were making our way through this. I was reading you a two-part article on ways to alienate your adult children. And we got through part one, How to Get Your Kids to Hate You, it was called. Part one was Emailed Cats, Unhappy Holidays, and Other Petty Crimes, written by Judith Newman. We completed that, and then we got into part two, which was Lost Legacies, Business Brawls, Secret Sons, Seven Ways to Make Kids Angry from the Great Beyond. This was written by Linda Stern. We didn't quite have a chance to finish that, so we'll take care of that, and then we'll look elsewhere for more entertaining articles in this magazine. In the list of seven ways to make kids angry from the great beyond, we did keep secrets and fail on follow-through and leave a mess, literally. Now we'll get to the next ones. The next one is make technical blunders. These are the worst because they are avoidable. Don't, for example, name one child as the beneficiary of your IRA if you intend for that person to split the money with the other children. The recipient will have to withdraw money from the account and pay taxes to cash out. Instead, name every person you intend to receive money on each of your IRA's beneficiary forms. Failing to keep a will up to date can be a problem as well. One father, Kotzer remembers, wrote his will during the dot-com boom when his stocks were worth millions. He left 20 nieces and nephews $10,000 each and bequeathed the rest of the shares to his two children, one of whom had special needs and significant expenses. By the time the father died, the stocks, once worth $2 million, were valued at only $230,000. The nieces and nephews got their money, but his children each got only about $15,000, much less than Dad had intended. Next, in instructions from the afterworld, be vague about treatment. The only thing worse than kids fighting after their parents die is having them squabble over mom's still-breathing body. But that happens time and again when people fail to plan properly for their end-of-life care, says Karen Wyatt, a hospice MD from Dillon, Colorado, and the author of several books about end-of-life issues. Parents often tell their children they don't want extraordinary measures, but fail to complete the paperwork so their specific preferences are documented and the children can participate in the medical decision-making. Or they name the wrong child as their health care proxy, say, picking the oldest because of birth order rather than the child best equipped to deal with doctors. And even with documents available, many families get confused about what everything means. Without a conversation, children won't fully understand what a parent intends. That creates a terrible bind for the child, Wyatt says. Childs recalls receiving a call from a hospital. His client's mother was unconscious, and five siblings were arguing over next steps. But without the proper designations in hand, the doctors refused to speak with any of them. Don't plan for remarriages. Everyone's heard this tale. Mom or dad remarries and leaves everything to the second spouse. When that person dies, his or her kids get it all. Kotzer tells the story of a client, let's call her Alice, whose grandfather, a Holocaust survivor, later became wealthy investing in apartment buildings. He promised his granddaughter, "It will all be yours one day." He died, and his daughter, Alice's mother, died unexpectedly shortly thereafter. Alice's father inherited the entire estate and ultimately married a young woman, introduced to him by Alice, ironically, who had her own young children. When Alice asked her father for a small sum to launch a boutique business, he turned her down, saying he needed the money for his new family. "But that was supposed to be for me," Alice said. "It's my money now," Dad replied, and they haven't spoken since. If Grandpa really wanted to protect his granddaughter, says Kotzer, he should have left half to her and half to her mother. Make them share. Leaving the family business to all your kids may not be the blessing or the glue to hold the family together you think it might be. Often one child is more involved than the others and will resent not being left a clear path to succession. Shiles oversaw one such case that recently settled after 8 years of dispute among the widow of the owner, the son who had hoped to take over the business, and his siblings. They all hate each other now, Shiles notes. Another couple, hoping to reunite long squabbling siblings, named their two children as their estate's co-trustees, Shiles says. The estate remained in limbo for almost 5 years because the two refused to cooperate. Shiles resigned from the case when it appeared there would be no end to the fighting. As for me, I'm doing my part to fend off fighting in my family. Note to self, get on eBay and sell that Howdy Doody lunchbox. Now here's an article on a tradition of service, frontline families. Four military families talk about the honor and sacrifice of serving in America's armed forces. This is written by A.J. Baim. First is the Williams Casey family, who represented Marines, Air Force, and Army. Herschel Woody Williams, 95, of Ono, West Virginia, is one of four surviving Medal of Honor recipients from World War II. In 1945, the young Marine used his flamethrower to wipe out several Japanese pillboxes in an assault on Iwo Jima. Woody's grandson, Brent Casey, 50, son of Harry Casey, an Air Force vet, served as an Army medic in Desert Storm, the Persian Gulf War. Why they served? Woody. When Pearl Harbor happened, I'd never heard of Pearl Harbor. I really didn't know much about what I was getting into. In the Marines, the emphasis was, we must win this war, and we are going to win it. Everybody supported the cause because we knew it would take the whole population to win. Women were working in factories, building airplanes and tanks and trucks. There was nobody I ever heard of who didn't support the cause. War in this country had never happened like that, and it has never happened like that since. Brent, I'm the only one of five kids who went into the military as a medic in the Army. My father and grandfather being in the military certainly played a role in my decision. I wanted to serve my country and see the world. The college benefits, which I definitely capitalized on, also attracted me. I was due to get out in September 1990, but when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August, I was no longer getting out. I knew Iraq was over there somewhere around Saudi Arabia. In the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein and Iraq were basically going into Kuwait and wiping it out and making the country theirs. In my mind, that's not how the world works. On war and fear. Woody, when we were getting ready to go overseas to fight in World War II, we didn't know enough to be scared. Once we got there, was there fear? Absolutely. I think anyone who has ever had the experience of war feels fear. But they tried to teach us that if fear takes control of you, you're useless. I never permitted myself to think that I was not going to come home. Brent, I was with the 82nd Airborne Division in Iraq, and my unit had Sheridan tanks. Our tanks had GPS and night vision goggles. Iraqi tanks did not, and I wish I had known that at the time because I wouldn't have been as frightened. In Iraq, our tank units ended their push at the Highway of Death, a six-lane highway where miles of trucks and tractors and tanks, bumper to bumper, were just burned in place, along with the people in them, by our Air Force. I still see it. It's the sight and the smell. That's the tough part. Woody. In 1945, I was told that I would be going to the White House to receive the Medal of Honor for his flamethrower attack on Iwo Jima. I didn't know what it meant. Going to the White House? It was very, I can't use any other word, scary. When I was called to go up to President Truman to receive the medal and he put the ribbon around my neck, my body was shaking, and I didn't understand why they were doing this. I had been doing what I was trained to do. It was just part of my job. Paying it forward. In 2013, the family launched the Herschel Woody Williams Medal of Honor Foundation. Woody and Brent crisscrossed the country raising money for and dedicating monuments to Gold Star families, those who have lost a loved one in military service. So far, 47 have been built. 55 more are in the works. Woody, I've been to every monument groundbreaking, and it feels like divine intervention that we've had the opportunity to do this. Next, we have the Bailey family, who represent the Navy and Marines. Larry Bailey, Sr., 67, of Zion, Illinois, spent 30 years in the Navy, most of that time as a medic on nuclear submarines. He retired in 2000. His wife, Mary Bailey, 66, spent 2 years in the Navy as a hospital corpsman. Larry Bailey II, 33, of Sumerduck, Virginia, joined the Marines in 2007 and was wounded while in Afghanistan in 2011. He is now a triple amputee who pursues his daily life with the help of prosthetics. He can walk and has moved into a new home with his daughter, Ayla, and dog, Audi. His home was built for him by the Stephen Siller Tunnel to Towers Foundation, along with other contributions. Larry, too, also drives his own car, works as an independent government contractor, and is planning to open a coffee shop near his town. Why they served. Larry II. During my freshman year in high school, the TV was always on in the commons area before classes, and I was watching on the morning of September 11, 2001. In that moment, we didn't know who or what had done this, but it kind of felt like someone was doing something to me. Later on, when I was ready to graduate, I told my parents I wanted to join the military. They both said, "We don't think you're disciplined enough." They were probably right, but after 2 years of college, and I also worked the whole time, I was ready to go. Mary, I understood the need to serve the country, and I thought it was a good thing for him to want to do. I was concerned that he would be deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, but I was proud that he wanted to do that. Larry Sr., he said, "I want to go into the Marine Corps." I said, "Well, you go serve as best you can. I know the Marines are well trained for the job they have at hand." I felt confident in the system, and I felt confident in him. On sacrifice. Larry II. On this day in June 2011, we had taken over the local Taliban commander's compound. We were exchanging fire. I turned around and yelled to them to pass me more 240 ammo, which is the type of machine gun we were using. As soon as it was in my hands, I pivoted, and then the next thing I knew, I was flying up in the air. It was weird because it was almost like in the movies. Then I was coming back down in slow motion and I hit the ground. The compound had been booby-trapped with IEDs. Next, one of my buddies, Jack Marino, was on top of me, smacking me in the face and applying tourniquets for my wounds. And we just hung out there until the medevac helicopter came in. As I was loaded onto the helicopter, I said something smart to the doctor and she just said, "We're going to put you to sleep now." The next thing I knew, I was waking up in a hospital looking at my family. Larry Sr., once the phone call registered and we understood that, yeah, he's alive, but hurt seriously, they told us we could be flown to Bethesda, Maryland to be with him at the Walter Reed Medical Center. We knew that we had to go there and we had to touch our son, okay? We had to for us to accept the fact that he was injured but still alive. Mary, we had a lot of support. The British Army doctor who had been out there in the field that day came to visit him at Walter Reed. It was the first time she had ever come to the United States to see some of the wounded warriors, and she wanted to see him. That was part of why he was able to survive and be here today, because of her and her team. And then for her to come and visit, we said she was one of his angels. Larry Sr., one of the things I understood about Larry from the get-go was his attitude. He had a positive attitude. The first thing he said when we saw him was, "Dad, I want to walk again." And we said, "Larry, we'll do everything in our power to help you, whatever it takes." Mary, my co-workers, the nurse practitioners, just came here to our house and took over. They were concerned about us. They took us to the airport when we got the news. They made sure we were eating. They made sure I got home from Bethesda because Larry Sr. ended up staying and being Larry II's caregiver for 18 months. Larry II, What I tell, what I tell other people is that one of the best things that can help you out if stuff is going really rough, I know people hear this all the time, but it's true, is to surround yourself with family, close friends. And if you don't have anybody like that, there are people, caregivers and others, who are willing to put themselves in that position. Larry Sr. Like Larry, Larry would go to other Wounded Warriors rooms and talk and encourage them and try to give them hope, because there were service members at the hospital that no one came to visit, and they'd lost the drive to live. So Larry would go in there and talk to them, and I talk to them too, like they're your son or your daughter. On What's Next, Larry too. Things like grocery shopping and getting housework done are easier now that I'm used to them. Small stuff can be annoying, like zipping a coat, because I have big hands and now one big hand and the prosthetic. But I don't have any regrets. I think about what ifs, not regrets. Next, we have the Burgess family. And they are from Air Force, Army, and Navy. These six women are descendants of the late Leon Burgess, a World War II veteran who spent 30 years in the military, mostly in the Air Force, and his wife, Helen Sue. They had four daughters, three of whom served, and two sons, one served. Laura B. Stevens Callahan, 67, of Hernando, Mississippi, spent 7 years as an attorney in the Air Force and 23 years in the Reserve and Air National Guard. Her sister Lucinda, Cindy Carlson, 66, of Midway, Kentucky, served for 7 years on active duty as a nurse in the Army and 21 years as a nurse practitioner in the Reserve. Their sister Melody Bach, 59, of Newark, Delaware, spent 7 years on active duty, mostly as a public affairs officer in the Navy, and 13 years in the Reserve. Laura's daughter, Sarah Johnson, 31, currently of Clovis, New Mexico, is a captain in the Air Force, serving as an intelligence officer. Cindy's daughters are Susan Harrington, 32, of Pensacola, Florida, who served in public affairs in the Air Force for 8 years and is now in the Reserve, and Bethany Gillen, 29, of Nashville, Tennessee, who spent 7 years as a nuclear service warfare officer in the Navy, finishing last August. This interview took place in Breckenridge, Colorado. Why they served. Laura, our dad never said to us, why don't you go into the military? He didn't discourage us, but he was probably as surprised as anybody that three of his four daughters went in, and all in different branches. Cindy, being raised military, you don't have a ton of money. All of us went to college, but I was first and accepted an Army scholarship, a wonderful way to get college paid for. Melody, I was in high school during the last years of the Vietnam War, and it irritated me that my little brothers could have been drafted if the war continued, but that I was excluded just because I was a woman. I thought, that just isn't right. I have a choice, and I'm going in. Laura, the day I put that Air Force uniform on, I was like, this is where I belong. When I finished my law degree and joined the office of the Judge Advocate General in 1981, there were about 1,500 lawyers and only about 130 were women. Today, there are a lot more women in the JAG Corps, the JAG, that's the Judge Advocate General. Cindy, our generation joined the military in peacetime. Our daughters have had it harder. They've had pretty difficult and painful experiences and a lot more deployments, things that we really didn't have to deal with. Bethany, we grew up feeling we needed to serve and that we ought to give back to the country that has given so much to us. I went to the Naval Academy in 2007, and I knew it was where I was supposed to be. Would I encourage my daughter to do what I did? I will make sure she knows exactly what she's getting into, because it's not easy. Susan, leaving for deployments was the hardest part, but I look back at both my deployments in Afghanistan, and I loved the people that I met, and I loved the work that I did. You're part of something that's really making an impact. Sarah, I'm coming up on my third deployment, and my husband has had four, so 8 years and seven deployments between us, 4 to 6 months every time. It's tough, but I keep volunteering for them, because for me and for my job as an intelligence officer, deploying is where it all culminates. It's what makes the biggest difference. I've had the chance to actually save people's lives. how they stay tight. Melody, we grew up moving around. It makes you more flexible. You can go anywhere and be comfortable, fit in. Laura, having phones has been really helpful. When Susan and Sarah were deployed over in Afghanistan, we could just call. But we also make a real effort as a family to stay close. It's always been that way. Sarah, you drive halfway across the country if you have to. You just do everything you can. The Gomez family, and this is an Army family. Gumersindo Gomez, 71, of Springfield, Massachusetts, served 20 years in the Army and saw combat in Vietnam. His wife, Eva Gomez, 57, served 6 years in the Army Reserve. Gumersindo's son, Giovanni Gomez, 50, served 3 years in the Army and later went to Iraq in 2007 and 2008 as a Department of Defense employee. Grandson Tyler Rodriguez, 21, is active duty Army. He had just finished a tour in South Korea at the time of this interview. Why they served. I was born in Puerto Rico. In January 1966, my mother shipped me to New York City to some family members. I started working in a factory making slippers. I used to walk down 42nd Street because they had cheap hamburgers, 2 for a quarter. I started watching the guys in uniform, and I started liking the uniform itself. I could remember back in my youngest days seeing my father in uniform and my godfather, who had just come home from the Korean War. I decided to join the Army, not even really knowing there was a war going on. I went to basic and advanced training at Fort Dix, New Jersey. From there, I went to Vietnam. I went to war. When I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s, my parents were strict, but I wanted to do everything a man could do. In our culture at the time, men were the leaders, and you had to do everything under a man. So I was always competing to see what a man could do that I could not. I wanted to try something different and not get married yet, like all my sisters did. So I joined the Army Reserve in 1981. I ended up training under one of the companies of which Gumersindo was the senior drill sergeant. That's how I met my husband. Now we have a big family and our grandson has joined the military. If our kids and grandkids make that decision, we respect that. We cannot put that fear in them. Oh, you cannot join the military because you're going to die. You can't live your life with fear. Tyler, for me, it started in high school. I wasn't doing well. I got in trouble my senior year and I couldn't play football. One day I was playing video games and my mom said, "Get dressed. We got to go somewhere." I asked, "Where?" She said, "You'll see when we get there." It was snowing and we came up in the car. I saw the sign, Armed Forces Recruitment Center. I was like, "Oh, God, no." I talked to the recruiter. I still talk to that recruiter today. I talked to my grandfather, Gumersindo. I talked to my grandmother, Eva. As much as I loved Springfield, I said, "That's it. I'm joining." I was scared to leave Springfield and my family, but nothing about serving the Army scared me. For me, it's been a good decision. On race and pride in the military, Gumersindo, we were colorblind when we were in combat in Vietnam. In the field, everybody covered everybody. Once we got back to the States, we segregated ourselves. Blacks had their place, Hispanics had their place, Caucasians had their place. Giovanni, growing up in the 1970s, all I knew was the Army. As a kid, because of my father's job as a drill sergeant, I lived on Army bases and went to Army schools. Army life is a society within a society. As a child, I did not encounter prejudice. You have no choice who your neighbor is. It's whoever the Army assigns. If Koreans are assigned, then your neighbors are Korean. If blacks are assigned, then your neighbors are black. You all go to school together. You depend on one another. Your dads work together. You get to be friends with everybody. But then when I was 13, my parents got divorced. Eva is my stepmother. And I moved to Georgia with my mother. That was the first time I experienced prejudice. I'll never forget sitting in class, and the kid next to me says, "What are you, black or white?" I said, "I'm Puerto Rican." He said, "No, you're black or white, and you ain't white." It blew my mind because in Army society, everyone was equal. Tyler, today in the Army, you're taught to respect everybody, so they don't really want you to speak Spanish when you're working. It's better for everybody to speak one language, English. It's all a brotherhood. Everybody looks at each other the same. I have brothers from every race. It doesn't matter to me. I don't see color. A lot of people don't know about Puerto Rican history in the Army. Some people don't even know that Puerto Rico is part of the United States. For me, there's a lot of pride because my grandfather taught me about Puerto Rican soldiers and what they've done for the American military. Giovanni, Puerto Ricans have fought in every major modern American conflict. Paying it forward. Gumersindo, when I retired from the Army in 1986, I started volunteering at a veterans center. I talked to veterans about post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which I had too, and noticed that many Hispanic vets do not speak English well, and that made their problems worse. A group of veterans and I opened 3 bilingual centers in Massachusetts in 1987, which we called the Puerto Rican Veterans Association, later renamed the Bilingual Veterans Outreach Centers of Massachusetts. I have been working to help my fellow veterans ever since. I don't want to retire. I have brothers and sisters who need my help. Now, here's a little sidebar to this article about places you can contact to help honor our vets. First of all, the Herschel Woody Williams Medal of Honor Foundation, a monument-building nonprofit to honor Gold Star families. They are at hwwmohf.org. Or there's the Stephen Siller Tunnel to Towers Foundation, which provides customized smart homes for injured combat veterans. And their website is TUNNEL2TOWERS.org. That's tunneltotowers.org. And then we have the Bilingual Veterans Outreach Centers of Massachusetts, which assists veterans and their families with navigating their VA benefits. And that you can get at bilingualvets.org. That's BILINGUALVETS.org. Now, we've just got a minute left, so we're going to close with a little entry in the personal best section. 50 Reasons to Love Being 50. And this suggestion is from Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Honor your family ties. When I started doing stand-up, I experimented with wearing a bow tie to set myself apart. Then I realized when conducting science demonstrations on stage that bow ties are more practical than straight ties because they don't get caught in the Bunsen burner. So the bow tie became my thing. I have about 500 of them because people give them to me. They're characterized by color and season, summertime yellows and greens, wintertime browns and blacks. My favorite is a two-tone blue one that my French grandmother brought back to the U.S. I've had tailors replicate the style, but none is as nice as this one. My grandfather taught organic chemistry at Johns Hopkins. My mother had a doctorate in education. I think the reason I've done okay in life is because I come from this tradition of academic achievement. That tie's a special one. I hope never to retire it. And now that's all the time we've got for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Hope you'll come back and listen next week. I'm Florence Nash, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. And the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long till next time.